From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
This is MC Fontaine welcoming you to another Bletchley Park podcast extra. This episode is the concluding part of the series of programmes that BBC Radio Gloucestershire have kindly let us share with our listeners, and is more of an insight into the personal lives of some of our great veterans who served at Bletchley Park and GCHQ. The next regular Bletchley Park podcast will be on July the 10th.
He was working in Hut 7 and giving us, along with several other chaps, work to do, and I really got to know him when I was on shifts, because there were only about five or six of us working, and we used to make coffee and tea. The Wrens used to stop, and they used to call it tea boat, which is apparently the term used in the Navy on the ships. And so we used to say to the men there, would you like some of our tea boat? And they thought that was very funny. So when we were on shifts, I was doing the drinks for the two or three men who were there during the evening or at night, and I got to know my husband quite well, so that during the day when we had our lunch break, we used to meet up, and then we both discovered we liked cycling, and he had a bicycle there and so did I, and on our days off we went cycling together. And so I suppose it developed from there. We had a lot of interests in common. He liked music. So I think on the whole, it was a sort of gradual development of getting to know. We certainly didn't talk about work when we were sort of at lunchtime or when we met or when we went out for the day. We met as friends, and that was sort of our main interest. In just going out and about. I remember we went to Stratford-on-Avon several times, and I discovered that my husband, who'd been at Cambridge, had learnt how to punt, and he took us out on a boat on the river in Stratford.
My future husband, who was the head of my office, I don't know what he did between then and I was sent to America in 1946, almost right after the war, and found him there in the office. It was a liaison office in which I worked. And now we have to be careful because we're talking American security, which is desperately tight, was then anyway. We went out, we started cycling round, and couldn't do much of that around Washington, but we did. We went to Glen Echo on the outskirts. But we then, of course, you went to places like Jefferson's Memorial, and we started driving around the countryside with the other chap in the office, who was called Bob Jackson, and another secretary. Well, I wasn't a secretary, but she was. And we went on holidays together. We used to drive all round more of America than my American daughter-in-law has been in, she told me the other day. But obviously not on bicycles there. And we went away for the weekend a couple of times to a place in North Carolina, which was gorgeous. And then in April 47, I married the one who'd been my boss at Bletchley. And we had to come home from America then, because A, they gave him another job in London, because I couldn't possibly be there as his wife, you see. It was all, you weren't allowed to be married to anybody in the office. So we came home. I had two little boys between then and 10 years later, when we were sent to Singapore. And my husband died, sadly, in Singapore. So that was my life, really. And then it was, my parents never knew what I had done at Bletchley. And, And we were released from our oath of secrecy, and I think I can't remember when. But then there were all these books, like Spycatcher started it, I think. And all manner of books then. Somebody who had been at the office, an air chap called Peter Calvacaresi, he wrote a book. My husband that I married 4 years after my first husband died also worked at with GCHQ when it had moved down to Cheltenham. So that GCHQ and Bletchley Park really has been the story of my life, though I never worked after I was at Bletchley Park, except for 2 years when I came back to my house in Cheltenham. We had all the whole office had moved to Cheltenham then. I went back to the office a bit after he died and met this chap in the drama club in the current GCHQ in Cheltenham, and went out with him for a bit, and then he was going out with somebody else, so I refused to go out with him until he quit going out with her, obviously. And then we got married in 61, and then I had another little baby, so it's really been GCHQ and babies for me, actually, after Bletchley Park.
Obviously, you both find love whilst working at Bletchley. What about other people? I mean, were there lots of relationships being
forged? Yes, there were quite a few marriages that came out of Bletchley Park.
And a few things other than marriage. They married each other's husbands and wives sometimes, I think.
Yes.
But that happens all over, doesn't it?
At the time we were working at Bletchley, it was much easier to find a mate than I think it possibly is now. There were many opportunities to meet men, and as there were, well, there were more women than men, so perhaps there was a bit of competition, but there were big opportunities. You were working with people on something that was sort of very close and together, and you know, many marriages came out of Bletchley Park. Everybody was signing the Secrets Act, and you expected to do that, and everywhere you were told not to talk. There were notices on buses and trains, do not speak, you know, keep mum. And it was expected that if you were doing any kind of war work, you never talked about it, not even to your family. So it was quite normal. We didn't sort of feel that it was anything to worry about. And I think that everybody was ready. It was part of your war effort to help out, to make sure that, you know, there was no enemy listening in.
Was it difficult, though, on a day-to-day basis when you're having conversations with your friends?
Well, we weren't, no, because all my friends were at Bletchley and everybody had signed the Official Secrets Act and everybody knew that they didn't talk to anybody else, not even in the park. You never spoke to anybody about what you were doing.
Being born in the late 1940s, by the time I could remember things, we would sit round and my father would talk about the war. My mother would never talk about the war, and I knew she wouldn't because my dad always used to say, "You signed the Official Secrets Act," and she just used to nod, and she would never ever say what she did. So she quite literally took her work to the grave.
We hadn't thought about talking about it at all, with that having been got used to it, you see, at Bletchley, not talking to your neighbours. We at the hostel, all the girls together, we just didn't talk about work. I suppose talked about boyfriends, if you had a boyfriend.
He wouldn't really discuss any of it with you. He might talk about one or two colleagues, obviously, and there were parties and you met various of his colleagues. But other than that, you didn't talk about it. No.
Signing the Official Secrets Act, that was part of it, and
yes,
Everybody accepted it. And lots of people have taken that to their graves. They've never spoken about what they've done to their friends, to their families, and haven't given as much information as you've given me today. What makes you different then?
Well, everybody is different. After about 90 in the 70s, it began to come out. Books were written, particularly, I think, by the Americans. And it wasn't till then that people like me and my friends, I suppose, began to talk, well, maybe to their families or to their other friends who weren't in the, you know, more effort. No, we didn't talk about it at all. Even my parents didn't know what I was doing. They knew I was at Bletchley and it was secret work, but that was all.
When you go home and your family are there, do they even try and ask you about what's going on?
No. My father was in the Admiralty and he was definitely, he realised I was doing secret work. He never tried to find out what it was. He may have known, I don't know.
And we do know that the one girl who was age 13, she lived on the park. There were only 4 children who lived on the park during the war. And at the age of 13, she was taken upstairs and she had to sign the Official Secrets Act. And we believe she was one of the first girls, or the youngest children, to people to sign the Official Secrets Act.
The group of friends I was with, yes, we knew what we were doing, and maybe we talked to each other at night when we were back in our billet, so-called, but it wasn't anything that you worried about. It was just that it was part of your war effort.
I think it's a different society then, and of course we were at war, so maintaining the secrecy was paramount, but it was also very stressful because they were terrified that they would ever say anything out of place. And during the research that I've done, I found one of the girls who needed to go into hospital and have an operation was terrified that under the anaesthetic she would start telling secrets.
But you forget all about Bletchley Park, you see. I never even told the children about it. I've been back since. I didn't go back first because I wanted to keep my sort of old memories of being there, you know what I mean? It was so ingrained in you not to talk about anything that you just didn't, you know, and not for ages. And when we were released from our oath, it was practically, you felt terrible talking about it, you know. It didn't come easy for it to wear off.
Because you'd both signed the Official Secrets Act.
Yeah.
What was that like? You're married, your husband and wife, you're raising children later on. And yet, everything that you'd done at Bletchley, you can't talk about.
Well, actually, we could have done because he was in my room, but we didn't because you just never talked. You see, nobody was interested. My children, I never even considered telling them because they wouldn't have been interested in it. You know, you just forget it, really. It was Bletchley Park. I think we got a letter of thanks from Churchill then, I don't think. He thanked us later. He called us the golden geese, or the geese that laid his golden, goose that laid his golden egg, or the geese that laid his golden eggs, yeah. But in fact, who's interested in it now is my odd job builder, who presented me with a tea cloth with those words on it.
There are intelligence officers, for example, who work for organisations like MI5 and MI6. There are agents who are the people that they recruit. And this is the sort of very glamorous world that you see in James Bond films. Ours is a very different sort of work. Ours is much more analytical, it's much more based, today it's much more based on technology, but it's always been based, I think, on a greater intellectual effort of examining the way other people's communications are set up so that we can get a better understanding of communications infrastructures and therefore find the way of getting to the actual communications that are going to be of intelligence interest.
Can you tell me about what happens at GCHQ now?
Nothing.
Ian Standen. I'm the Chief Executive for the Bletchley Park Trust. As you will hear from the pigeon flying over us, this building is now derelict and not in use, and is one of the buildings that in the long term we'd hope to bring back into use. Okay, we're standing here in Block D, which is the biggest surviving building on the Bletchley Park site. It came into use in 1943 as one of the many buildings on the Bletchley Park site as it expanded from this cottage industry it was at the start of the war to the industrial co-breaking factory it was by the end of the war. Called GCHQ as a cover name during the war is of course the antecedent of the current GCHQ. I mean, GCHQ and us work very closely together. Clearly we are, if you like, they're outside the Wire Museum. We tell the story of their history from where they really started. And many of the artefacts we have in our museum come from GCHQ. We have them on long loan to us to help us interpret what went on here during the Second World War and why it's so important now to where we are today. You know, the origins of cyber warfare and cybersecurity come from Bletchley Park and the work it did in the Second World War.
We've released pretty well everything up to the end of the Second World War, up to VJ Day in August 1945.
I mean, we have a whole archive of material that GCHQ have loaned to us, much of which still needs to be looked through in depth. There's lots of information in there that hasn't been catalogued properly, so that's part of our ongoing work, is to catalogue and digitise the archive here so we can readily access the information. And there's all sorts of stories in there related to, you know, episodes during the Second World War, particularly things like Double Cross, where we were feeding the Germans misinformation, and there's still more stories to come out of that. And of course we have a number of machines, particularly Enigma machines that belong to GCHQ, which we show here in one of probably the biggest collections of Enigma machines in captivity.
My name is Beryl Middleton. I'm a widow and my age is 88. I was a wren, and I think I became a leading wren, which it doesn't amount to a lot. And I was there for about 2.5 years. We were living through a life and death situation, and it was terribly important that we won the war and that what we were doing was helping the war. And whatever we could do to make things work and safe and secret, we would do. We would go along with it. And it was something that you wouldn't have betrayed what you were doing. And so I think this is something we need to sort of make sure that people realise now, that it was very, very important, and it's a very important history, and that's why Bletchley Park needs to be kept going and, supported.
I think the scale of what happened at Bletchley and the scale of their results is still something that stands out in the history of intelligence.
I'm Nina Horwood. I was Nina Edge at Bletchley. My age now is 89. I was 18 when I went to Bletchley, and I worked there from October 42 to when I went to America in June 46. Somebody said to me once, "Oh, you're moving to Cheltenham. The only trouble with that is you think there's nowhere like it when you get there," which it's very, you don't actually want to move much from Cheltenham. I think it's, you know, you get settled in Cheltenham and there's everything here, really. Societies, I recall my husband saying there's a 16th century guitar society, a 17th century guitar society. Everything you could wish for, really, in societies and festivals.
Cheltenham was favoured because it had a race course. This is what the rumour was. I don't know whether that's true, but it's very nice and very glad we came to Cheltenham.
My name's Peter Westcombe, and I'm a volunteer at Bletchley Park, and I started the campaign to save the park in May 1991. Cheltenham is standing on the shoulders of Bletchley Park. Bletchley Park is standing on the shoulders of the older rooms 40 and MI1B. So therefore, it's progress all the time, building one on the other on the other. And sooner or later, somewhere is going to succeed Cheltenham, and it's going to, in fact, be taken over. It will take over from Cheltenham, stand on Cheltenham's shoulders. That's the way it goes on there. And so that's the way it works. And it's got to work that way because, you know, as fast as things advance, so you solve the problem, then another problem turns up. You know, one problem creates another one for the cryptographer, for the cryptanalyst. Yeah, so, yes, but it keeps people employed. Gave me a pension.
Thanks for listening. Why not follow our channel on Audioboo, where you can also subscribe to the RSS feed, or you can subscribe to us in iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter, where we're at @BParkPodcast, or join the Bletchley Park Facebook group. And of course, we must thank Audioboo, who make this podcast possible.